Blog Talk Radio.
What's Happening, Blog Talk Radio. And tonight is Tuesday, April 6, 2021. And our call-in number is 347-857-3293. And by now, you should know this program is an analysis of the news and of history and of current events in terms of the American capitalist system. And we're saying this is an anatomy of oppression, because that is what any capitalist system is. And we're also saying this is an anatomy of colonialism and imperialism, which predates fascism. It's colonialism, not just racism, stupid. So tonight we have our usual suspects. We have people who do nothing but study oppression and study liberation and struggle to change it. Without further ado, let me tell you tonight's topic and theme that we will be addressing. What is an army of occupation? What does it do? What is a police force? What does it do? Kip Fitzgerald, the oldest living political prisoner, transitioned, and he lived. We are the dead, not Chip. The dead, unable to mount a movement to free him. Let's not fail Mamiya. Let's not fail Shakur. Let's not fail all the other political prisoners the way we failed Chip Fitzgerald. So without further ado, Brother Ralph, what's happening?
Thank you so much for that. And my brothers and sisters, as you can hear, we are a bit bitter. We are hurting. And one of the reasons that I am hurting, because I feel that as a progressive, as I describe myself as a progressive, as an educator, as I describe myself, I have failed the people. For early on in my career, as a person in New York, 1962, having met Queen Mother Moore, she said the words to me, "They tell me you're smart. They tell me you're educated. They tell me you have degrees." And she says, "Now you tell me why you do not speak plainly. Because if you do not speak plainly and clearly, the people will not understand and not be able to react to the truth that they do not understand. And so I am going to try to use examples to speak clearly, because my people, our progressive people, do not speak clearly. We use the term police department when it's not a police department. It's an army of occupation, and I'm going to use recent situations that we're all well aware of to show the difference. What is an army of occupation? What does it do? An army of occupation terrorizes the people that it is occupying, like the Americans in Vietnam. They were not a police department, although they said it was a police action. The Vietnamese knew the difference. They fought. They were willing to take losses of 20-1, and they published it when the Americans came to fight. And they said, "We can beat the Americans if we just keep them at 20 Vietnamese dead to one American." Well, as close as the Americans got was 11-1. And so if you studied politics and political education and the question of colonialism and imperialism and liberation, you knew that the Vietnamese were going to win. Very simple math. And I use that as an example. First, they taught the people what an army of occupation was. The people in America were told it's a police action, but the Vietnamese knew different. It was an army of occupation, and they were willing to fight at 20-1 ratio to get rid of them. Freedom at any cost. 50 years is not too long to fight. These are the words of Ho Chi Minh, the great Vietnamese liberator. Many young Americans went and died. They had no idea what they were doing there. And as Muhammad Ali told us all, "No Vietnamese called me nigger. I ain't going." Our young brothers and sisters did not understand that. Muhammad Ali went further to say, "You're going 6,000 miles away to do to other people of color what is happening to you here in America." Malcolm X told us that. We still don't know it, and I get very upset when I hear people say, "We need the police to be trained." Let me give you some information here, my brothers and sisters. Just a couple of weeks ago, a young man killed 10 people in Colorado, killed a policeman. And the police are trained. They did police work. They arrested him, handcuffed him, and he had a wound on his leg. That is policing of a community. Another young man shot six young Asians. They did police work. They captured him without incident. That is police work. They don't know, they don't need training. But we here in New York know of a young man, just a particular young man in Staten Island who was selling loose cigarettes. They killed him on the street while people were asking them to stop killing him. That is an army of occupation. That is terror. And we have the incident. It's an insult to listen to the trial of what's happened in Minneapolis to deny reality on the big screen. Everybody knew they were killing that young man in front of the population and daring the population to do anything. That is a terror force. In Chicago, it became known about 10 years ago that for 20 years, a captain or an authority on the army of occupation was torturing people into confessions. I think they gave him 5 years, something like that, for torture. We know that our political prisoners are tortured, waterboarded. That's an army of occupation. That's what they do. And we have to show that we know the difference, and if the next person who calls in and says anything about a police force, I'm going to ask them if they are white. Because if you are black, if you are living in a community of color, you know the difference. So stop lying to yourself and your comrades. Stop and frisk in New York. That's what an army of occupation does. They don't have to have a reason to stop you. All you have to do is be black in a black community. You can actually be black in a white community, and they will stop you because you're black. That's an army of occupation, and we must resist. There are stories of resistance, and we can't go over it. But I ask you, please understand and speak clearly to each other. Chip Fitzgerald, shackled to his bed on his death, chained and shackled because he was a political prisoner, a person who understood politics, who joined the Panther Party at 17, was arrested shortly after, and understood what the fight was. He is and was a political prisoner, a hero of ours. The Central Park Five are political victims. They were young black boys at the time of their arrest, just hanging around the park. And the army of occupation terrorized them. Their parents didn't have rights when they went to visit them. They could not visit them. In a society with a police department, you have a right to talk to your child. You have a right to take a lawyer to your child. They had no rights. They are victims of a political system that terrorizes, that uses terror to keep a community in check. Now, what am I talking about, keep a community in check? We must go to history. There was a time in America while the genocide was going on, the genocide of killing the indigenous people, there was slavery to make money. The greatest example of a money-making machine was a plantation, and I'm going to try to cut to the chase. The plantation that is still operating today, it's called Angola.
Mm-hmm.
Angola Prison. It's a plantation. It's slavery. Corporations are making money. Not only in Angola, but in many prisons around the country. And when prisoners refuse to work and go on strike, the force of terror comes down on their heads. But they are on the inside, and they understand. I don't think they are confused or use confusing language among themselves. And just recently, and I'm going to conclude with this, a middle-aged black man kicked and stomped an Asian woman in full sight of the public. And we find out later, he's deranged. How do we know he's deranged? He did 10 years in prison for killing his mother. But he's out here, walking in the street. This is a political system that allows terrorized, insane people to walk our streets. Everyone is at risk. And just a brief word, they kept Chip Fitzgerald in the prison, and he wrote a letter, and I'll just read the first line. Chip's statement upon my release. Upon my release, I will welcome the warmth and laughter of my grandchildren. I look forward to their hugs and smiles. I will be the grandpa present to soothe them through occasional scrapes after they show me their somersaults and expert bike riding maneuvers. This is a human being who understands and loves people, but this society could not tolerate this type of human being who understood and fought for his people's liberation. So stop confusing your language. We are here to educate people. We are suffering under an army of occupation. They know the difference in Chip Fitzgerald and the Central Park joggers or the Central Park victims of a political system. They know they made a mistake. But what was the result of their mistake? It wasn't a mistake. They terrorized the woman. The head terrorist is promoted, probably retired with a great pension. She did her job, and her job was to terrorize our community, which let us know that any day you're walking in the street, a person of color, they can bring you down. This is what the job of an army of occupation is. I don't want to rant on, but I want you to please understand that when we say we are dead, not Chip, we are dead because we are unable to mount a movement to free him and other political prisoners. When I say let's talk, you get on this program, we're going to talk truth to power. We're going to honor our brothers and sisters. We're going to do the work. We're going to stop being political slaves. That's a reality. And we indeed are political slaves because we give our vote to people who are not working to give us our political remuneration. Maybe we don't even know what political remuneration is. And number one in remuneration, you get my vote when you support our political prisoners. You don't support our political prisoners, you don't get our vote. I will call it quits there. I am emotional. And along with that emotion, there was a program over the weekend of Sister Betty, what the program was.
We had a Zoom for the People's United Front. We had participants from all over the country, but the performance that stole the show was a video of our Professor Louis. It was amazing. It brought the house down. So without further ado, the poet of the hour, our poet in residence that enables us to keep the spirit of Sister Lynn Stewart alive. Professor Louis, your mic is open, and congratulations, even though it was a video, it was wonderful. It had an amazing effect.
You knocked them out just as you knock us out every week. Professor Louis, the microphone is open.
All right. Burning. The young bloods went in burning. There was no turning back, Jack, down at Broadway and Grand. They had their Jim Johnsons in their hand. In a heartbeat, Rover, it was over. No one called Jehovah. The blood ran red, but the gold had fled. The whistle was blown, but the money had flown. The roller showed, but everyone had blowed with a tremendous stash. Thousands in cash that didn't last too long. That was spent and gone after getting it on for three solid weeks of big-time freaks, three solid weeks of party that was much more than hearty. New music, new clothes, new treats to put up the nose, new girls, new smoke, new pills, new coke, but the dues that had to be paid. There's sure enough blues when you're not afraid of the trap that was laid, the cage that was made for animals but filled with men, gone to the pen. Some never gonna see the street again, buried alive in a hard rock jail. Had to survive, no mail, no bail, buckets of tears, locked up for years, bricked up, tricked up, and sent up to die. Once the people could fly, but by and by, now it's clubs and chains, oceans of pain, the wasted lives piled one on top the other. Once a month visit from your mother or brother, a living, breathing fatality in the hard white hands of brutality. No family, no friends, no chance to make amends, nothing to defend, all coming to an end in the big house upstate, locked down behind iron gates, in the cold steel jaws of the penitentiary, where we finally got a pause, 'cause it's elementary to know, fast or slow, when the young warriors feel the heat of the street through their feet, feel the need to beat sometimes and not always lose, feel the blues rising under the skin, the news coming in, maybe we can win. Then now's the time to tell that we must study well the world around us, the darkness and power that's around us, trick bags shining in the sun, know well which way to run, know well which way to point the gun. If the weight must fall, and fall it must, don't let it fall right back on us. Before you dance out on the warpath in your trance or romance, better do the math. Before you step out with your truly righteous anger, don't be another headbanger in a bar, some little ripoff of Ma and Pa, a little run for the money that won't go far. Before you step out with your truly righteous hatred, don't let it be you who's got to pay for it. Lost in a world with nothing for you, there is always something that you can do. The children need you, and you know it's true. You can let the children judge you. Grandma down the block needs you a lot, and you can let the children judge you. Your brother needs you, what you gonna say, and you can let the children judge you. Your sister needs you every day, and you can let the children judge you. Your daddy needs you, don't throw it away, and you can let the children judge you. Your mama needs you in every single way, and you can let the children judge you. All the children near and far, the children need you out of the bar. The children need you with or without a car. The children need you just like you are, and you can let the children judge you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, Professor Louis. As I say over and over again at the end of the program, I go back and I tune in our program that is archived. Sometimes I don't get any further than Professor Louis because I want to be educated. He educates and entertains at the same time. Brothers and sisters, listen up. He's talking about our condition. Thanks again, Professor Louis. Sister Betty.
We have to move right along. There is so much happening. The forces of oppression are on the rampage with their new world order. And so I want to go to Sister Nellie Hester Bailey, our warrior from Harlem, but she's more than that. She's a scholar, and she's a researcher of what they're up to. Sister Nellie, your mic is open.
Thank you, Sister Betty and Ralph. I just want to talk about a crisis that is going to be upon us, not only the pandemic that we've been living with now, it seems forever, but the moratorium on evictions. And here in New York City, the moratorium ends on May 1st, 2021. We talked previously about tenant relief funds that the state has, because originally New York State had allocated $100 million for tenant relief. But by the end of 2020, only $40 million had been spent. So the New York State Division of Housing and Community Renewal, which is a state regulatory agency, sent out announcements very hurriedly. You can apply for a tenant hardship no later than May 1st. And as we know, May 1st is literally right around the corner. So if you haven't filed or submitted an application for tenant hardship relief, you can do so. You can submit the form directly to your landlord. And please call the Office of Rent Administration of the New York State Division of Housing and Community Renewal at 833-499-0343. And again, let me repeat the number, 833-499-0343. And when you call the number, if you haven't filled out an application for tenant relief, please indicate to them that you want the form, or they will tell you where to go, because DHCR has offices all around the city, and they will give you the office closest to you. There is one on 125th. And one can also visit the website of the New York State Division of Housing and Community Renewal. And again, let me just give you that number again, because we want to keep repeating this for your hardship relief. Call the Office of Rent Administration, 334-990-343. And hopefully next week we will have some up-to-date information for you. Housing court is proceeding not as it did before, because the court has a tremendous caseload. So if you are already in the system, just remember, don't panic. It's going to take time for them to get to your case. And again, you can call the Office of Rent Administration, and we'll be around next week to give you some more updates and some more news about how you can protect your home, because we certainly are in need of home security. All right. Thank you, Sister Betty and Ralph. That's my report.
Well, thank you so much, Sister Nellie Hester Bailey. We are talking about a program of education that helps you negotiate and navigate and to understand the system you live in. We can't say that number often enough. It is 833-499-0343. And as Sister Nellie Bailey tells us, we'll be talking about it next week, because if you don't have a home, if you are homeless, you're in trouble, because one out of four people who are homeless this year are going to be not with us next year. They're going to be gone. And I think of myself with my skin cancer as homeless. When it's itching and I feel like tearing my skin off, I jump in my shower and then grease up. As Mumia Abu-Jamal says, he's so glad to be back in circulation where he has his Vaseline, where he can grease up to soothe his skin. Vaseline is his medicine. And I could go on. When you can't go on and you can't make it, I'm just going to stay in bed a few more minutes. If you're homeless, what bed are you talking about? And all of these little things that we think of. If you're homeless, you're in trouble. Thank you, Nellie, for helping us to avoid the trap of homelessness. Sister Betty.
I also want to say to people, if you want to really hear Nellie shine, tune in this weekend. Google the Black is Back Coalition website. They're going to be holding their annual electoral campaign school, and Sister Nellie Bailey is one of the featured speakers on this webinar. Without further ado, we have to move right along. We want to keep in with the message concerning Mumia. Brother Henry Higgins, your mic is open. And thank you, Nellie.
Thank you, Sister Betty, and thank you, Brother Ralph. We want to call people's attention to the fact that this coming April 24th, there's a demonstration in support of Mumia's 66th birthday and his demand for compassionate release from prison. His health is daily endangered by the conditions that they insist on maintaining against him. I'd also like to read a quote that Johanna Fernandez used in an article that she wrote several weeks ago, and it's from James Baldwin. It says, "History is not merely something to be read, and it does not refer merely or even principally to the past. On the contrary, the great force of history comes from the fact that we carry it within us, are unconsciously controlled by it in many ways, and history is literally in the present in all that we do." James Baldwin. So please, gather your resources. Let people know that we're fighting for Mumia's life. It's been constantly in danger, and we cannot let the powers that be succeed. I also want to share with you an article. Let me just simply mention the sources of information that you can pick up on Mumia. Mobilization for Mumia, Campaign to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal, International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia, and the Free Mumia Abu-Jamal Coalition, New York City. Those are sources of information. You can pick them up on the website, and they will keep you apprised as to what's going on in regards to Mumia's case and the support demo in April for Mumia's 66th birthday. And we want to emphasize the need for his compassionate release. Mumia should never have been in prison in the first place. I want to share with you an article or brief excerpt from an editorial issued by Workers' World from the March 18th edition. "The former Republican president may be absent from the corporate media these days, but his racist and pro-rich ideas live on in all reactionary political organizations and institutions. This ideology flourishes in the Republican Party's current assault on the universal right to vote. We are well aware of the limitations of elections in capitalist society. In the United States, election winners, even locally, are nearly always from the two major capitalist parties. Big money donates. The billionaire-owned corporate media enforce pro-capitalist ideology and trash anyone promising even mild social reforms. The United States Constitution itself imposes inequality by disproportionately empowering states with small populations. It traps the presidential contest in the Electoral College. It fills Senate seats with the rich and reactionary. Despite these already existing biases, this 2021 Republican-led assault on the right to vote aims to take inequality to a new level, or better said, to a time before the 1965 Voting Rights Act, when not only all the states in the former Confederacy, but many others prevented African Americans from voting. To revert to that period, Republicans have introduced 250 measures in 43 states that target black people and all people of color by placing a minefield between them and the voting booth. These rights, won in struggle from the post-Civil War era to the Civil Rights Movement, must never be surrendered. We must combat this offense to deny voting rights by fighting to expand the right to vote. This includes rights for incarcerated workers and released workers with felony records who are disproportionately black and have been denied their right to vote for years, sometimes for their entire lives. Migrant workers denied citizenship are also barred from voting. And then it goes on and it summarizes itself with the following paragraph. Unlike the Democratic Party, working class and revolutionary organizations have a duty to defend the rights of the most oppressed and exploited sectors of the population, whether it's the right to organize unions, to form tenant organizations, to support movements to defend civil rights, or to mobilize the vote. This duty amounts to significant anti-racist solidarity to help strengthen class unity, smash the attack on voting rights, extend the right to vote to all. And I want to just leave it there and again emphasize to people that voting rights is very important. What's going on in Georgia is an assault against all of us, and if they're allowed to succeed there, then they'll be allowed to succeed in other places, which they're working on right now. And again, we want people to come out on April 24th in support of Mumia in Philly. Mumia is a treasure that we must save and protect, and his life has constantly been in danger for these low 40 years. So thank you very much for this opportunity to address our audience.
Thank you so much for that, Hager Henry Higgins, for your educational instance here. And this is what we are about. The struggle continues. Join us. Allow us to join you. And we will win. For we must win for ourselves. And if you can't fight for yourself, think of your children. And if you can't fight for your children, think of your little sister, your daughter, your granddaughter. Although Lynn Stewart told me all of the years, that's incorrect, because your granddaughter may be the greatest warrior you ever heard of. And so, but I think of those little people, and it's easier for me to fight when I think of the young and the babies and the females, although I'm incorrect. Thank you so much for that, Henry Higgins. Sister Betty.
We're going to go now to another Mamiya or political business supporter, definitely a supporter of Sister Lynn, and one of the major players in helping her come home. Brother Gil Obler, your mic is open.
Hi, thanks. And thanks, Henry, for that introduction to the issue. So I just want to reiterate what Henry just said. And the lead article now on freemumia.com is about April 24th and has some information about the events there, but I'm still working on, there are going to be events globally on the 24th, and there are also going to be events on Philadelphia the whole weekend, the 23rd and the 25th as well. As Henry mentioned, we're going to have vehicles, buses, and vans going down to Philadelphia on the 24th because that's the major event, the major march and rally. So if people can join us, we'll be leaving from the northeast corner of Union Square near 17th and 4th Avenue and Broadway there on the northeast corner of Union Square on April 24th around 10 a.m. It's really important because of COVID that people make advance reservations. if they're going to join us. So you can call the hotline, 212-330-8029, and get in touch with us, or you can write to bus@freemumia.com. And you can go to that article on the main site. I'm going to be adding events in other places, the Bay Area, Europe, et cetera, as well as the events happening on Friday and Sunday in Philadelphia. We're also having an event at the same place, the same location, the northeast corner of Union Square, this weekend, this Saturday, April 10th, between noon and 2. And then basically we just want to give people an opportunity to get bus tickets and also give them updates on the details of Mumia's legal and medical situations, the history of the movement, what people can do to help get Mumia out, et cetera. So if you can join us this weekend between noon and 2, that's the same location we're going to have the buses leaving from, so that we can, you know, we want to kind of get people together and figure out as a group what we're doing. So, again, that's going to be this Saturday at noon, northeast corner of Union Square. And if you can't join us, call the hotline or write to us at bus@freemumia.com.
Thank you so much, Gil. We knew we could count on you. People, what you're looking at is a total front of unity. Bring our political prisoners home. And with that in mind, we're going to New York City, Jericho, but she's much, much more. Sister Ann Lamb, your mic is open. Thank you again, Gil.
Thank you, Gil, yes. Thank you so much, Sister Betty, Brother Ralph. Always an honor and a privilege to be with you. Speaking of the weekend, there is some other stuff coming up before. But the Sunday, April 25th, is in the spirit of Maroon. Long live Walter Wallace, who was killed by the police on the same block where Time Africa lives. So, as you know, Gil already said, the Saturday event, and there's a Friday evening event, which is a virtual fundraiser and speak out on the 23rd. Activist youth, writers, and musicians express what Mumia means to the movement today. Then Saturday we'll be taking to the streets. It's Mumia's 67th birthday, and that's starting at 2. There'll be a rally in March, ending at around 6, they say. Now, on Sunday, starting at 8 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, April 25th, we will be having a community cleanup prayer and celebration at the Maroon Garden in honor of Russell Maroon Schultz, which is at 58 and Spruce. So this is a garden that's already there. There's a mural there of Russell's mom. I believe it's across the street from the house where he grew up. And his family is really doing this. So they want the community to come, help clean up the garden, maybe plant some plants would be nice. Then at 1, we take to the streets, because at 2 to 5, there is a demonstration at Malcolm X Park to remember Walter Wallace Jr. and to continue to honor Maroon, Mumia, and all freedom fighters. Then at 6 p.m., in observance of Ramadan, folks are invited to return and break fast in the Maroon Garden, where they are planning to do an iftar for the community. So it's a very busy weekend, a lot of stuff going on, but very important that we are bringing also Maroon into this space, as I'm sure Mumia himself would say, and as Maroon himself would say, you know, we're all together in this. So it's a busy weekend, but it's very important that people come out for that. So people should definitely be in touch with Gil. If you can only come on the 24th, come on the 24th. If you could come and stay for the 25th, even better. The virtual fundraiser, I assume, will be online, so we can probably watch it everywhere. And also, I just discovered an event that's happening this Friday, the 9th, which is called, it's a Facebook event. It's going to be streamed on Facebook Live. It's called 50 Years Behind Bars, Jahlil Muntakim, COINTELPRO, and Lessons for Today, done by the Coalition for Civil Freedoms. I just finished putting it up on JerichoNY.org. If people are interested, it's going to be Friday at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. But what's very interesting about this to me is that the lessons for today are going to tie in with Dr. Afia Siddiqui. Now, Dr. Afia Siddiqui you know, this is something that we know about but has not been so well known as some of our other political prisoners. She is currently serving an 86-year, I repeat, 86-year sentence at this place we know so well, Ralph, right? The Federal Medical
yes.
Center, at Carswell, Texas.
Lockup camp.
I know you know it
Texas.
Well.
Yes,
and
I know it well. I've visited many times, but continue.
Wouldn't call it a medical center, that's for sure. Anyway, I want to speak a little bit about Afia because she was totally framed up, too. You know, I mean, it's really disgusting. And the Judge Richard Berman, he was totally disgusting. So she was sentenced back in 2010, and basically she was framed up. She's a post-9/11 Muslim political prisoner, as we would say. And a person who happened to be at her trial as a witness, he wrote this short report, which is good to hear. The story that the U.S. told in court involved a group of military and FBI ransacking an Afghani police station looking for Afia. They then stopped to have tea with the police chief, 24 people plus furniture in a room that was roughly 20 feet by 30 feet. A soldier rested his rifle against the wall and took a nap. This is the story the U.S. told. Afia walked out from behind a curtain, picked up the rifle, and began shooting. Afia was shot by another soldier, and she was seriously wounded. No one else was shot. The next day, soldiers and FBI returned to collect evidence, took pictures of everything, found 2 bullet holes, but no bullets. These were the holes Afia supposedly made. On the last day of the trial, the defense provided photographic proof that the bullet holes were there the day before the shooting. The prosecutor simply said that the bullets went somewhere else. Afia did not leave fingerprints on the rifle, nor blood stains, nor did the rifle show evidence of having been fired. The scientific evidence refuted the eyewitness accounts of the event. This is the definition of reasonable doubt, except if you are Muslim. The eyewitnesses, so-called, got significant promotions and rewards for their participation. The Afghan interpreter got a green card. One of the FBI guys was put in charge of Attorney General Eric Holder's security. The list goes on. This is the definition of reasonable doubt, except if you are Muslim. Evidence of her involvement in terrorism was introduced. A handbag found in her possession containing dangerous items. She was not allowed to challenge this because it was not relevant to the charges, but it was still admitted as evidence against her because it made her scary. Everything above was part of the trial. I was there. I am neither judge nor jury. I am a witness. Now, people may not know this, but Afia Siddiqui was living here in the United States, right? She has a doctorate degree from Brandeis University. She has a Bachelor of Science degree from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She is a Pakistani neuroscientist, all right? So I just want people to be aware of that. She does have a page on Facebook. If you go on Facebook, you can look for free Afia Siddiqui. I believe this is done by her sister, Dr. Fauzia Siddiqui, who has been making, you know, very important. People in Pakistan have been making a lot of noise about this case. You don't hear about it so much here. But it will be interesting if you can listen to that discussion, because Maurice Salakhan, who has been very persistent and insistent on fighting for Afia Siddiqui, will also be speaking at that webinar on Friday, April 9th at 3 p.m. So that would be one of, you know, the continuity of COINTELPRO from back in the 60s and 70s to now, you know, and it should be an extremely, extremely interesting discussion. So I would definitely encourage people to check it out.
Thank you so much for that, Ann Lam. And the question of Afia Siddiqui is nothing but fraudulent.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in Washington, D.C., in front of the White House with the Lynn Stewart literature, I had Afia Siddiqui literature. And a woman from Pakistan came to me and said, "Who is this American woman who dares to support the cause of Afia Siddiqui?" Her name is Lynn Stewart, who has
That's
left
right.
us. Thank you so much for that. We have so much to learn from the terror. They took her children, and that's just the beginning. They've driven her into madness. This is what terror organizations do, and I call the American government a terror colonialist organization. Sister Betty.
Without further ado, we're going to go to another valiant, strong warrior in the cause of Sister Lynn. Dolores Cox, your mic is open. Thank you for your patience.
And
Vivia,
there. A couple of weeks ago, I heard on the news that an elderly person living in a housing project in the city died while walking up the stairs to her apartment. She lived on the 17th floor. She was asthmatic, and her oxygen tank ran out. She was walking up the stairs because the elevator was broken. I've heard so many stories over the years of housing project tenants going without heat, not water, toilets not flushing, ceilings falling, lead paint poisoning of children, mice and roach infestations, elevators not working, etc. And these families I've noticed that live in these developments seem to be overwhelmingly Black and Latino. So it had me wondering again about the history of housing projects, and what I discovered was the role of the federal government in creating and or perpetuating ghettos with its housing project policies. There's an article that I read entitled Race and Public Housing, and it talks about how public policy created and remains responsible for the segregated ghettos in which too many Black children live today. Residential racial segregation, accompanied by social and economic hardship, burdens the learning of many urban children. From the 1930s session into the early 1950s, faced with housing shortages compounded by a flood of returning war veterans, cities constructed public housing for white working and middle class families, beginning in the Lower East Side, including white immigrants. These projects for stable white families became highly prized treasures, the most desirable housing available, and they were located in mostly all-white neighborhoods and admitted only a token few Black residents, if any. And it says that, in the cities, the projects for low-income African-Americans were put in ghetto neighborhoods and sometimes in neighborhoods to which planners wanted to relocate a ghetto. Projects for low-income Blacks were heavily subsidized with federal and sometimes state and local funds. There were also privately owned and built and owned developments that were subsidized by public land clearance and tax breaks, such as the whites-only Stuyvesant town here in Manhattan. These remain today as middle-class urban islands, but forgotten have been the truly public projects built, owned, and operated by government for working and middle-class families. The Woodside Houses in Queens, it mentions, was one of these. The Housing Authority carefully screened applicants for projects like Woodside. Preference was given to war veterans. Only two-parent families were accepted, and applicants had to produce marriage licenses to prove their status. Investigators visited potential tenants to verify they had good furniture and housing habits and well-behaved children. Stable post-war employment records, good credit, no teenage pregnant daughters were also required. When the Woodside Project opened in 1949, its tenants were 92% white, and surrounding neighborhoods was nearly a Black face, it says. In South Jamaica, the Housing Authority built a project for low-income tenants, which is 30% white when it opened pre-war, and went down to 12% white by the mid-1950s. And this was guided by a rule established by the New Deal stating that public projects should not alter neighborhood racial composition. The rule ensured that few low-income whites would live in South Jamaica, and few middle-income Blacks would live in Woodside. But projects like Woodside, filled up with middle-class whites and other federal policies, lured these families out of projects into wider suburbs. These were the mortgage insurance programs of the Federal Housing Administration, and the VA, from which black families were mostly excluded. In the 1950s, a single family home construction accelerated white families, and they took advantage of these guarantees to leave from Woodside and similar projects for the suburbs. FHA and the VA guaranteed mortgages were so favorable that monthly carrying charges were often less in comparable rooms and square footage than the rents that they paid in the public housing projects. And it says whether the city, in the city of suburbs, the FHA required developers seeking their financial inclusion, restrictive covenants in their homeowner deeds prohibiting sales or resales to African Americans. For example, Levittown, a suburb just east of Queens, was built in 1947 with 17,000 mass-produced two-bedroom houses, requiring veterans to put nothing down and make monthly payments of only $56. At the FHA's insistence, the developer, William Levitt, did not sell homes to blacks, and each deed had a prohibition of such resales in the future. Of 300 large private subdivisions built from 1935 to 1947 in New York's Queens, Nassau, and Westchester, 83% of them had racially restrictive deeds with racial restrictions, except for domestic servants of a different race that was domiciled with an owner or a tenant. As whites fled cities, public housing units were filled with lower-income African-Americans. In 1968, the city abandoned its middle-class public housing programs, and long-term tenants with middle-class incomes who did not voluntarily leave were evicted. The Housing Authority announced that it would abandon previous requirements of employment, equity, and orderliness, and would no longer consider, quote-unquote, the morals of the applicants. Many economically and socially distressed minority tenants, some with unruly teenagers, were funneled into the once middle-class projects. It changed the population characteristics that were accompanied by deterioration in projects' upkeep. Students attending neighborhood schools now had drastically different and greater needs. And just add a little more, it says that with public housing, federal and local government increased African Americans' isolation in urban ghettos. And with mortgage guarantees, the government subsidized whites to abandon urban areas for suburbs. The contribution did heavily to creation of segregated neighborhoods and the schools that we know today. With truly disadvantaged minority students isolated in poverty-concentrated schools, where teachers struggle to overcome families with multiple needs, these public policies, the racial achievement gap that has been so daunting to educators, would be a very different and lesser challenge. Residential segregation, as much as the product of purposeful public policy, as was quote-unquote legal school segregation, that legacy continues today. And it adds that these patterns were not unique to New York City. They were repeated nationwide. That's what I wanted to add tonight.
Thank you so much for that, Dolores. And as you remember, a program, a person said, Ralph, are you saying that the New Deal is racist? And I say, yes, I'm saying it. Not only racist, but corrupt.
Well, without further ado, we've got the mic open for Sister Cynthia Morgan from Brooklyn, the Republic of Brooklyn. Can you please give us a shout-out, Vivia?
Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph. Also, I want to say good evening, special good evening to Nellie Bailey. Thank you for that information. I would definitely share it because a lot of folks are going to be homeless, you know, and that's vital information. So I want to say thank you to that. Also, this Sunday, we're doing a special It's My Park Day planting memorial in honor of Bunny Wailer. Bunny Wailer was a founding member of the Wailing Wailers, Bob Marley and Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer. He transitioned March 2nd, and we just wanted to It's my party day in his honor, and plant some bulbs and pinarios, and we're asking people to come out and plant, because we know that a lot of lives were lost, right? And if you want to plant something for a loved one, Sunday, April 11th would be the day. We start at 12 p.m., and that's at Wingate Park off the field. So if you come out, you're going to see a lot of people gathering in that area. If you come on the field where they usually do the concerts, we'll be in that area. So,
well, thank you for that, Vivia. And people, remember the name, Vivia Morgan. She's running. She's on the ballot. She's our team. She's of the Charles Barron type of politics, supporting the people, and we have much more to say about that. And in closing, I want to say, this is Ralph Pointer, and we must recognize that WBAI faces another attack by the same forces that shut down the station for weeks 18 months ago. They turned in a petition for a referendum to change the bylaws that govern Pacifica and WBAI. The changes would remove community control of Pacifica. Key leaders of the referendum want to sell WBAI to solve the network's financial problems. Join Momia and many other activists who have urged WBAI supporters to vote no. But to have voting rights, you must have donated at least $25 between April 8, 2020 and today, April 7th. To renew your membership with a credit card or a card of a debit card, call 212-209-2050. Again, 212-209-2950 to get voting rights for this June's referendum. Do it before 11:59 on Wednesday, April 7th. For more info and a copy of Momia's statement, go to WBAIFightBack.org. That's WBAIFightBack.org. This is Ralph Pointer and Sister Betty Davis saying thank you for tuning in this week. See you again next week with more information and spirit to fight back.